You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
Hello, how you doing? I'm Craig Parkinson. You are listening to the Two Shot Podcast. Sit yourself down, pop the kettle on. We're going to have a nice old chat. Who's it with this week? I'm going to tell you right now. How the devil are you? Well, good. I'm glad. It's Thursday, so yes, it's episode 83 of the podcast. Thank you so much for subscribing and downloading. Very short intro this week. Two things I want to say. Apologies first to you. Why, Craig? What are you apologising for now? I'll tell you. Your badges were supposed to be arriving to your house this week. I've been called away for work. I'm currently recording this in a hotel in London, and I'm not there at home to stuff all those envelopes, but I'm going to get onto it next week, so just bear with and thank you so much. Another thing, this episode, right, I want to preface this episode with a warning, really. This is probably the most candid conversation we've had on the podcast, and my God, we've had a fair few, haven't we? It's the actor Connor Swindles. Now, you might not know the name. If you've seen Sex Education on Netflix, you'll certainly know who I'm talking about. Look, if you're in a dark place or you're feeling brittle, just be careful with this episode, because we talk about anxiety, we talk about death, we talk about grief, we talk about loneliness, we talk about alcoholism, and you'll hear in the conversation there's sometimes where there isn't any words. We just had to, it felt very natural to just pause and just let what was said sort of breathe. So yeah, look, it's incredible, and I'm really pleased that Connor came on and felt that he could be so candid. So yeah, tell you up, just if you're not in a great place, maybe just wait a bit, or maybe it might be of comfort to you. I don't know, but I just thought it important to tell you some of the topics that we cover, about Connor's past, where he is right now, and sort of achievements for the future. So look, let's get down to it, okay? This is episode 83 of the Two Shot Podcast with Connor Swindles. I'll see you at the end.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
Have you ever had a medical for a job where they check your balls?
I've had a medical, but only like not an actual physical touch medical. Just one when you have to tick the thing, like no. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And maybe they like touch your like body. I've never had them check my balls. So.
I went last medical I went to. I said I always like having these medicals because I very rarely need to go to the doctors because I'm you know, touch wood, very rarely ill. And he went, well, these can't really show anything. It's just like for insurance purposes, you know. Yeah, so you could be really ill. And I went, all right.
Yeah.
Cheers. So that then spiraled off my worry that maybe I have got cancer.
Yeah.
Of the balls. I know. Please help me. Don't say things like that.
I know. The doctor that I saw today, because the reason why I went, and I'll talk about this as well, is because, are we going now as well? No. So my grandfather on my mum's side died from bowel cancer,
right?
And then my mum died from bowel cancer as well when I was like seven. So I've, and it's definitely got worse with moderate success that I've been through. Do you know what I mean?
Because the worry's got worse.
Yeah, because now I think oh, that would be fucking, that would be the perfect ending to the story, is like, you've got all this great notoriety and, you know, and now it's like, you're going to die. So it's definitely got worse, and I'd never been to the doctors about it before. And I was kind of hoping that he would be like, yeah, you know, I understand why you're a bit worried, but you're probably fine. And the moment I started describing to him, he was like, you have every right to be worried.
Did he really?
Yeah. And I was like, oh,
what, man, did that do to your worry? Did that spiral out of control? Did that cement it? Did you feel you, oh, well, if he's saying I'm right to be worried, then I should be worried. Then,
well, the other thing as well is like, you know, the reason why he said, yeah, you have every right to be worried, is because, you know, two people in my family have died from it. Yeah. So it, at the same time, if he had said, nah, I think you're fine, I probably would have walked out and gone, that doctor is shit. He, you know,
I'm still going to worry, exactly, so nothing would have changed.
And he was basically like, you know, you don't need to worry, because if anything does happen, if anything does change, you know that you'll get it checked out. And I think both my grandfather and my mother, one of the main reasons why it got them was because they're from a family of like travellers and stuff like that, where you just don't go to the doctor until you're dead.
You deal with things yourself.
Exactly, you just man up. And that's probably what got them. Whereas I'm the opposite. I have such horrendous anxiety and health anxiety that I can't. The moment I feel anything, I'm like, I'm dying. This is it. Yeah. You know? Especially, that's what I mean. It'd be like the perfect. That would just be perfect. You know what I mean? I think that all the time.
But of course, this is going to happen to
exactly,
me.
Exactly. Yeah.
At this moment.
Yeah.
Think everything else is going right. Tick, tick. That's yep. All right. I feel very happy. And of course, I'm just about to get run over by this truck.
Exactly, yeah. I do think like that, which is annoying, because when good things happen, you can't enjoy them. You can't enjoy them because you're always worried about what's around the corner or what's, you know.
Are you always like that?
I think so. It's definitely something I struggle with a lot, in that the moment I have any sort of success, I can't enjoy it, because I just think, fuck, something's going to happen in 2 minutes which is going to end it all. There were times where I couldn't leave my house, because I was like, I just have to, like, if I got a job, for instance, I'd be like, I just have to be safe until I've done the job, and then I'll be fine. Do you know what I mean?
Is it about mortality? Or
probably, yeah, I think so. I definitely have a weird complex about that, and always have, obviously, because I lost my mum at such an early age. I think that would...
How old were you, Connor, when she passed?
I was seven. I was six. I think I was six or seven. She was 46, I think. 48 or so. But yeah, I think that definitely has had a massive effect on me in every way, growing up. And anyone that's lost a parent knows that as well, like, in terms of relationships as well. It's definitely...
What does it do to relationships? Does it make you not want to enter into a relationship because you fear it's going to end?
Or? I definitely went through that, yeah. And now it's more like... I fear all the things that my... And it ties back into her getting cancer as well. Driving over here then, I had the thought of like... Oh, what if, because my dad tells a story that he was at home and he was at work and she called him up and she was like, it's cancer. And then I get that fear of like, oh, am I going to make that fucking same phone call to my girlfriend and be like, do you know what I mean? So
what does that do for you day in, day out? Does it stall things? Does it stop things? Oh, of course it sometimes stops enjoyment of things.
Yeah, I think... Yeah, I mean, it is definitely an everyday thing that I deal with, that. And then but then part of me feels, you know, that I have a duty to also educate people on it as well, and maybe do something in that regard. And maybe that's why my mum died from it and my grandfather died from it. It's that so I won't, or, you know, so that I can help people that are going through that or whatever, I don't know.
That's certainly a positive way of
but then looking there's, at there, but then there's so also tragic. In that, if I'm being brutally honest with myself, that's also me being like, oh, maybe if I talk about it with people that I won't get it, so it's selfish as well, do you know what I mean?
But I think you've got to talk about these things.
Yeah,
I mean, you know, if you didn't talk about your feelings, your everyday feelings, and they were all bottled up, then where are they going to go?
Yeah.
And then you'd be worrying that, well, they're not getting anywhere, so they're going to turn into cancer.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
It's snowballing, isn't it?
Yeah, I think... Oh, I think... I think general anxiety, anyway, just doesn't help. And like, we both know, working in this industry, how...
unforgiving
and just weird your life is. Do you know what I mean? My girlfriend's doing a play at the moment, which is about to open at the National, and I just think, fuck, I could never, in the state that I'm in right now, there is, I could not get on that stage every night and do that. But then part of me also thinks, oh, maybe that's just what I need. Maybe I need not to be in my head so much, because I just predominantly do film and TV. So,
but does that change when you step on set? Do you forget?
Yeah, it does. But that those are far and few between, you know what I mean? Being on set. I mean, I'm lucky that I've got a gig at the moment, a sort of regular recurring gig, so. But then, you know, I'll get such horrendous health anxiety. And I know I'm just going on a tangent about this now, but
it's all right.
I'll get, we're about to start filming season two of Sex Education in the next couple of months, and part of me is just like, just make it through, just survive for that 6 months.
Already, is that what you're thinking? Yeah, yeah. If I could just get over that finish line.
If I
could
just make that and then I can die, I'll be, do you know what I mean?
Fuck, mate.
That's how crazy it gets, yeah. I'll be like, I've just got to make it to that. If I can just make it those, do you know what I mean?
I know what you mean. I don't know how healthy it is.
I know.
To think like that.
I know.
But you do say you don't think about it when you get on set.
Yeah. Yeah. And
so
I think,
what can you do in your everyday life to incorporate how you feel when they say action?
Well, I think partly I've put off going to the doctors for a long time anyway, so I think that's definitely going to be it. And my girlfriend just said, you need to fucking go to the doctors and get it looked at. But I think it's like a hereditary thing in my brain that both my mum and my... that I get it from that side of the family of just burying your head in the sand.
Right.
That's what I was saying earlier. I think that's where it comes from, is that's what got them, is they buried their head in the sand for too long, and then when they finally pulled it out, it was like, you've got 6 months left or whatever. Well, I think it's lucky that I'm more aware of that than they are, and I'm definitely more aware of like my mental health than both anyone on that side of the family is anyway.
Do you think this is more a mental health situation than a physical health situation?
I think so, yeah.
Have you talked to anybody about that?
I'm starting to go to therapy now. Before it gets any worse, do you know what I mean? I think, and Maddie and Siam, you know, my agency, you guys know, they're really great and they're the most understanding people in the world. When it comes to things like this,
Well, because they're a support network. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, I know you've got like, you've got your girlfriend, you've got your friends, you've got your family, but sometimes the people that you work with day in, day out need to know where you are within yourself, because they're, it sounds quite coarse, but they're selling you.
Yeah.
And it's a representation of them as well.
Absolutely,
so they've got to be there with you.
They are the best. There have been, you know, plenty of times where I've just been like, I can't do what you're asking me to do right now, because I'm just crippled with whatever it is. And you know, listening to Joe when he did the first one, what was that, like a year or two ago?
That was a year ago, yeah.
That
I think it was more or less around the year to the day, Griff, between both episodes. Yeah,
that was a massive help as well, to hear his struggles with mental health and anxiety and things. And
do you get to ever a point where you think it's just you? But I mean, even prior to that,
I do, because my brothers, who were both sort of double my age anyway, I don't know what it is, but they just don't get it. They just don't get... I tried to talk to them about, they're so... I don't know what the word is. They're working class men, and they're men as well. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
They're both labourers and they...
And also they're of a different generation.
Exactly, yeah. and a different upbringing to me. I grew up with my dad, who was very in touch with his emotions after my mum died, whereas they grew up with my mum on that side of the family, which was sort of all a bit out of loop anyway. But if I try to talk to them about their feelings, they, it's not even that they don't want to talk about it, they just don't get it. They're just like, why would I be depressed?
It doesn't compute with them.
They just don't understand. They're like, why? I have nothing to be depressed about. Why would I be depressed? And I think, well, don't you ever wake up one morning and just feel slightly anxious about something? And they're like, no. They just, it's not even that they're trying to deny it. They're trying to hide it. They just don't get it. So that makes me feel alone, because I'm like, I'm the runt of the litter that's somehow the mentally weakest out of all three of us, and the physically the weakest, because I'm skin and bone.
But then again, I don't even think it could be incorporated as mentally weak. I actually think there's something very strong to be able to acknowledge that, even though you can't completely put your finger on what's not connecting, that the circuits aren't connecting, but that you know that something's wrong. Surely that's a strength, no?
I think so. I think part of me is also like, because I used to be a boxer, and back when I was doing that, I didn't give a fuck about all this. I thought I was invincible, for one.
Yeah.
I had this weird invincibility complex where I thought I was untouchable and I thought I was hard as nails, and I would have never worried about any of this stuff back then. So part of me always thinks, what was the shift in that? What was the shift in my mind from that point to now that has now turned the opposite? I think partly because I don't exercise enough anyway, and that breeds anxiety, I think, for me, who being an athlete anyway, coming from an athletic background.
Were you always very sporty?
Yeah, and I think so, but not typical sports, not like football, rugby, but I boxed for a long time as a kid. And
right.
And I think that plays a big part in it as well, and the fact that I now do a job that doesn't require me to brainwash myself into thinking that I'm tough as nails, whereas in boxing you do.
And also with boxing you get a tremendous release, whether you're in the ring or you're training, don't you? So,
and you feel viciously alive when you're fighting. So maybe that's what's missing now, but I don't want to replicate that in my life. I would rather now talk about feelings with people than have to get punched in the head to realise that I don't. Do you know what I mean?
And also now you're doing a job where
I can't get punched in the head because I need to learn my lines.
Well, you can. I don't know, I got my head cracked open once by a fire extinguisher. So, you know, who knows? Yeah. And also you're doing a job where the majority of the time you sat around.
Exactly, yeah. Just thinking. Yeah. I think it will do me good to be... Like, I would recommend therapy to anyone, obviously. I think it's just hard for me because I'm quite self-aware anyway, do you know what I mean? So part of me is like, well, is the therapist just going to tell me things that I'm already telling myself? But maybe that's just what I need, is those things to be sort of what I was looking for from the doctor today, for him to be like, yeah.
Possibly, yeah. But I suppose if you don't dip your toe in, then you never know, do you?
Exactly. And then it will just, you know.
So, Connor, let's go back to childhood.
Sorry.
No. Don't need to be sorry, my friend. Not at all.
Waffling room.
Whereabouts did you grow up?
In a few different areas around West Sussex. Moved around a lot when I was a kid.
Right. Why were you moving around?
Because of like the... So I lived in a place called Chailey, which is sort of near Burgess Hill, from birth to around the age of six. And I lived with my mum and my dad. And I think they split up when I was about five, I think. And then I just lived with my mum and I didn't really know my dad. And my dad moved back in with his parents.
Right.
In a village called West Chiltington in West Sussex. And I think he had been made bankrupt at that time as well. And he was a manic depressive as well. So he moved back in with his parents because he needed to be taken care of. He needed people around him. And I think that was one of the reasons why they split up in the first place, is because it was a lot for my mum. And then she got diagnosed with cancer when I think I was six. And then she had like 6 months. And then she was dead by the time I was seven. And then I moved. My dad sort of showed up and was like, you're going to live with me now. And he
Was he down on the mend at this point, or certainly on the road to getting himself fixed?
He was definitely doing a lot better. He was with his dad and his mum, and they were, you know, there for him. They were a support network for him. I think it just gave him a bit of structure that he didn't have before. I mean, I don't really know. I think suddenly being faced with a child that you have to take care of and the loss of your wife, there's two things that one is really bad and the other's like you don't have time to, sometimes you don't have time to grieve when you're faced with another thing. I think
that ceases to become about him and right. He's got a child to look after.
Exactly. So then I moved in with him and his parents, my grandparents in the country. And
do you have a good relationship with the grandparents?
Not really. I mean, 4 months after I moved in there, my grandfather dies, who I was living with.
Right.
So then it was just the three of us. He died from he had a massive stroke because he was boozing and drinking, and he wasn't telling anyone that he was having mini strokes because he liked drinking and smoking too much.
Oh, Jesus. Right. Okay. Another one for sticking his head in the sand.
Yeah.
Fuck, man.
And that caught him. And then it was just the three of us. It was my gran, me and my dad, and she was sort of she was my mum for, well, longer than my actual mum was, really, for about 10 years before she died when I was 17. And we had a vicious relationship as well, me and her. We hated the ground that we walked on.
Really?
Yeah, she was...
Where did that stem from?
I think a lot of it was worry on her behalf. If I look back now, she was more terrified that I was going to end up in a bad way. But I wasn't really rebellious. I was quite quiet. I wasn't really doing anything wrong. And I think that worried her. I think she thought, well, why is he not rebelling? Why is he not acting up in school?
Because she couldn't gauge where you were coming from.
And then it would come out in anger. And I was just a bit of a shit anyway back home. Like, I, you know, didn't tidy my room and stuff like that. But she would get overly angry over those things. And then we would fight a lot.
You know, your mum passed when you were seven. That, you know, we're talking about now you're 17, it's 10 years. It's not like you've been in and out of therapy dealing with the loss of your mum and the grief. Right. So,
yeah.
I suppose surely it's going to come out in some way, isn't it?
I mean, I look back now and I do think everything she did for me, she did only do to because she was trying to
help you.
Yeah. And make me.
You'd hope so, wouldn't you?
Yeah. And, yeah. It would be stupid of me not to think that and to look back and think that. But we definitely had a very rough relationship with each other. And she had just lost her husband as well. So,
and she was dealing with that exactly. as well. So how was your relationship with your dad at this point? And how was he with it himself?
He was definitely... Well, we were all weirdly sort of taking care of each other in that my gran was basically having to raise two kids again.
Okay, yeah.
One of them was 40, in his 40s, and one of them was 6 or 7. And then my dad probably felt that he had a duty to look after his mum, who had just lost her husband, and his son. So he was sort of distracted by that. Things sort of really got bad for my dad after that had gone away. By the time I was old enough to take care of myself and my grandmother had passed away, he sort of spiraled down a darker path as well because he felt like he didn't have any structure anymore. There was no, I dare I say, purpose, but...
Well, no, I think you're right because he didn't have to take care of you because you were slowly starting to become a man and looking after yourself. His mum wasn't around anymore. So, yeah, you're right. I think that structure sort of fell away. So, therefore, maybe he did as well.
Yeah, and he's definitely been a big drinker his whole life. I think that goes without saying. So, and that only made things worse as well. And I lived with him until for a couple of years after my granddad, till I was about 19. And at that point, things, and he won't mind me saying this, but things were really bad in our household situation. It was sort of like every other day he was having an episode where he would be like crying and screaming and drunk and stuff. And he has really bad, he broke his back 10 years ago and he's got ridiculous chronic pain. So it's this weird sedation thing as well of, you know, painkillers and alcohol, and that's never good. And
that's not helping his mental state at
all. Exactly, yeah. And he lives in the middle of nowhere as well, so there's no one to talk to. There's no one to, you know, And he's not really big into that anyway.
But you did say before that he's quite in touch with his feelings.
Yeah, he's definitely more emotional than the other side of the family, let's say, who right. are, you know, uber masculine and uber macho. Can't cry, you can't show any pain or fear or anything like that.
Be a stereotypical
man. Yeah. Toxic masculinity is definitely
rife.
Yeah. But at the same time, I had my older brothers who were there for me as well, and they were the best. They were always, they always took care of me if ever I needed anything, or, you know, they were always there for me. And I feel like that was sort of my mum's last wish, was like, take care of your brother. And they always have been, and they're the best. If it wasn't for my older brother, Danny, I definitely wouldn't be an actor now. He was the one that, after I stopped boxing, I was sleeping on his sofa and going to doing like rehearsals for community theatre auditions and things like that, or rehearsing for community theatre and then going to little auditions, sleeping on his sofa because I couldn't afford to go from mine to where the auditions were in London. Right, he lived closer. That was probably for a year I did that, slept on his sofa, and he's got three kids and a wife. So I owe a lot of it to him. Another, like, I've gone off now, but...
No, it's all right. We go off everywhere.
If I pull back to my dad, we were living together. Things were pretty rough, and we were living in a council flat in West Sussex where there's nothing. And I was like, fuck, I have to get out of here.
Yeah.
Because each day I was there, I felt like I was dying. Do you know? I was like, I have to get out of this place. What is the quickest way that I could make enough money and just dash out as quickly as I could?
Yeah.
Up until this point, I hadn't really done any acting or anything.
What was school like at this point? Were you getting on with it, or were you keeping your head down?
I did horrendously in school just because I thought I was... Because up until I was 17, I was a boxer, so I didn't try in school whatsoever because I didn't think I needed school to be a boxer. Because I thought that's what I was going to do. I was going to...
Oh, did you?
I
was gonna, yeah. Was boxing going to be a job route?
I think that I was deluded enough to think so. I look back, I'm like, there is no way in hell that I could have ever been a professional boxer. But at the time, I definitely thought so.
Yeah, of course. And of course, you were much younger at the time.
And me being weirdly obsessive and extremist, I'm either food or famine. I'm either all in or all out.
Well, it's a good job you're an actor then, because that's kind of what the game's like, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. But with, like, you know, with that came the loss of any education or any sort of academics that I could have... grass. So I left school, I didn't have shit to me.
So what did you think was the next step when you quit boxing?
Well, my brother said to me, you're going to have to come work with us on the building site because that's all you're going to be able to do now. So I was doing that and quickly realised I can't do this forever. Yeah. And they knew that as well. So that sort of spurred me to find out what I need to figure out what I'm going to do.
Do you think maybe that was a lesson to you to come and do what we do and then figure out what it is you want to do, because they secretly knew that this wasn't the life for
you?
Yeah,
I think so, yeah. There was no, you know... cost them money, if anything.
It's quite a fatherly thing to do, yeah. Just going back to you saying about what you think your mum's wish was for your brothers to look after you. It's quite
absolutely,
a fatherly thing to do, isn't it?
And I didn't have any money anyway, so, you know, me and my dad, we had no money when we were living together. Like, we would run, you know, the electric, like, the electricity, you know, the key thing. You go down the local shop and they top it up. We had that. And we would run that into the emergency every single week because we just to get a little bit more money on the Monday. So that, like, there, not a week went by when we didn't run that into the emergency.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? The emergency.
Yeah. The key slot and it would go onto the rest.
Yeah. So, I mean, we were dirt poor growing up and...
How's your dad now? How's he surviving now?
I mean,
sort of financially, I've got a feeling I kind of know where he is within himself, but is he on benefits?
He's not working, is he?
No, he can't.
He's on benefits. And if ever if ever he needed money, I would always give him money. Do you know what I mean? A big part of it as well was if I become successful as an actor that it will make him happy, and obviously that's never the case. I thought that my success would be
could fix where
exactly.
he is.
Yeah. And it just doesn't, it doesn't happen. It doesn't work like that.
No. But you said that your relationship that at that time was quite fractious.
Yeah.
And you needed to get out. How's your relationship now? Now you've got distance.
Oh, yeah. So getting distance was definitely the best thing that I could have done for both of us.
Well, it is the key sometimes, isn't it? If you're thrown in that situation and it ain't working.
And we don't speak as, obviously, we don't. We lived every day together for 10 years. And now we probably speak, you know, once a month or so. But that's definitely what works now. And he loves sort of all that acting and the success that I've been lucky enough to get. But he definitely... he's definitely struggled a lot his whole life. And that makes me feel bad as well. Do you know what I mean? Sometimes I think.
Does it make you feel guilty?
I think so. I think it's something that I might have to pay for later on in life.
Or maybe that's just your worry again.
Exactly. Yeah. I know. This is me being stuck in my head too much, but...
But aren't we all sometimes? We all are. You know, we all overthink every day. We're at the supermarket, we're overthinking.
Yeah. I think that's what garnered me into being... But I have to be thankful for all the shit that has happened, because if it hadn't have happened... For instance, let's say I do have bowel cancer. If my mum hadn't got it and she hadn't died from it, I might not survive from getting it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Sometimes you get dealt a shitty hand, but if you're prepared for it, then maybe you can work with it. So maybe that will happen, and maybe that's... But maybe if that shit hadn't have happened, maybe I wouldn't survive it. Do you know what I mean? I don't know. But another part of me as well is like with the stuff with my dad, if that stuff hadn't have happened, I wouldn't have had such a drive to be like, I have to get the fuck out of this house.
And you won't be sat here right now.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I can't not talk shit about all that stuff, but
you're just being honest though. I don't think you're disrespecting it in any way or slagging it off. I mean, it's you're just cataloguing and talking about the past,
right? And I definitely thought all that shit that happened, surely I could take that and put it into acting, and if I don't, then all that stuff is only just pain and it'd be wasted, really. Do you get what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, at least like, I can transfer pain into something else.
When did you think about that? Because your brother put you on that building site and went, oh yeah, this is not for me. Because at this moment, it's been purely quite boxing-y.
Yeah.
Right? So where did the acting come into it?
I mean, I'd done like mandatory drama classes at school, like everyone had to. And the teachers would always be like, this is what you're going to do. But I always felt that it wasn't an honourable thing to do, because I idolised my brother so much. He worked on building sites. It's like, am I really just going to go and fucking fart around and pretend to be someone else and get paid?
That's not what a man does.
Exactly.
That's not masculine in any way.
Guilt, do you know what I mean?
And
tried to reject that idea. So I tried to be a boxer and I tried to be an athlete instead. And it was always like... I feel like I've had no say in it, really. It was like always kind of creeping back to, or being pulled, this gravitational pull.
Yeah.
And then the moment I made the switch and was like, this is what I'm going to do, all the stars aligned, and it was just like constant fluidity for the first time in my life. Whereas everything else I ever did, it was like I was pushing a rock up a hill. And then the moment I started to do acting, that I was pushing it down, you know what I mean? And it just let it roll.
How did that feel within yourself at that point, if that was the first moment in life where things seemed to be connecting?
Well, it was also one of the first moments anyone had ever told me, from the moment I did something, this is what you'll do. Like, I didn't walk into a boxing gym and have some, you know, squinty-eyed boxing coach shout across the floor, that guy's going to be a champion. It was never that. It was the opposite. I got my head kicked in every day for over a year before I was any good at that. But then the moment I started acting, first thing someone came up to me and said was, this is what you could do. And that was a big moment for me.
Did you feel that was a possibility within yourself?
No. I remember the guy that I spoke to was a man named Michael DeCruz, who sort of became like a mentor to me as well. He was directing a community theatre play down in Brighton at the time. And I remember thinking in my head, I'm going to go up and speak to him, and I'm going to say, do you think I can be an actor? And if he gives a hint of any slither of, I'm going to walk out and I'm never doing it ever again.
But on the flip side of the coin,
he was like, this is what you're going to do. And that was it. And then I just went for it. And it was I'd never done it before. I didn't know what I was doing. So I thought maybe you have to go to drama school and you have to do that. And I auditioned and didn't get in.
How did that make you feel? Did that put a brick wall up to you? Did you feel that, oh, that's the route that everybody goes down, or certainly a lot of people went down and you weren't going down there? What were you going to do next?
Well, he said to me before that, he was like, you're not going to be a theatre guy, because when you act, you've got like 10 minutes and then it's done. In that, if I do a scene, for instance, like, you better hope the camera's rolling, because afterwards I'm probably going to leave and not do it again if it's going to be really taxing for me. But that's just because I don't have the skill set to be able to go into a place and come out of it. So it tends to be, like, even on Sex Ed, there was a day where, and that's like a dramedy, it's a like, you're not really meant to be crying during that film or that show. And there was a day where I just lost my head completely and had to leave for 45 minutes. And JJ, one of the producers, who's amazing, was coming over and being like, we're not going to do it again. You know, if you want to say no to this, we can just stop and we can call it a day and we'll see what we've got and try and make something.
That's amazing that they were so supportive.
So supportive.
Because, you know, it's a lot of young actors, and even especially your character, I mean, he's never himself until sort of right at the end till he admits a lot of stuff. So you're dealing with, oh, you might see this person on the outside, but you can't see what's going on within.
Exactly, yeah. And I knew that to myself, if I don't go back in and do this, then I've failed. I've been beaten by myself, effectively.
So did you?
Stopped me from doing my job. Yeah,
yeah.
I did go back in and we finished it and it was great. But what I'm saying is that maybe I'm just too psychotic to... I do think sometimes maybe I'm not cut out for this. Maybe this isn't something that I'm meant to do, just because I can't handle my emotions sometimes. And Michael said that. He said, you can't do a play because you can't get up there every night and do this because you'll die. And I know that in myself as well. I don't have the emotional stability or the endurance to be able to replicate high emotion night after night like amazing actors do.
Well, you say that, but I know an incredible actor who on stage is probably one of he's a brilliant actor, full stop, but he's one of the best theatrical actors I've seen, because it costs him so much. You believe that he's going through this pain right there in front of your eyes, but it costs him so much. And for him to do a full week, he's physically drained
and
mentally spent.
Yeah.
There's nothing left in the tank.
Yeah.
Then I spoke to a brilliant director about him, and he went, the thing is about him, if he could only do 3 shows a week,
it'd
be amazing.
Yeah.
But then we get somebody else to do the other 4 or whatever it is.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't think you're alone in that, actually. And this actor I'm talking about is in his 50s. So he's been doing it a fucking long time and he really knows his craft. And it's, you know, you do see people, I see people on stage and I go, that costs you nothing.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Yeah.
And I'm not saying it has to cost everybody something when they get up there. And I don't want to see the blood all the time. I don't need to see the snot and the shit and the pain and the tears. But if I do and I believe it, amazing.
Yeah.
But I don't think... What I'm trying to say is I don't think you're alone in that.
Yeah, yeah. No.
And I don't think you should ever think of that as a weakness.
Mm.
Not to put a block on getting on up there on stage. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. It's definitely, especially my girlfriend, she does tons of theatre. She went to RADA, she's trained, she's amazing. So, and she does inspire me to do those types of things, but then at the same time, there's part of me that, and if I just go back again to what Michael said to me, he said, you know, you'll do film and TV and that will be where you find your flow. And he was right. And he got me in touch with his own agent at the time, who was a small-time, sort of smallish agent.
How old are you at this point?
19.
Right.
I went for a couple of auditions with her. My cousin, who's a casting director, I'd been begging her for probably that year to see me for something. And this, you know, she was like, what the fuck are you talking about? You want to be an actor? You were a boxer. Like,
oh, so she didn't know she didn't any know of at this. All.
So she, I'm begging her constantly. And she's like, this is, how do I know this isn't just something like, I see serious actors come in here. And why am I going to let you just walk in and take this thing? Begged her and begged her and begged her. And eventually she saw me for something and told me on the spot, okay, you're not going to get this part, but you're great. So I'm going to send the tape to a few agents, and I'm not going to tell them that we're related, because I don't want it to be nepotism or anything like that.
Yeah.
So,
and people are very quick to judge.
Exactly.
In this business.
And she didn't want her. She didn't want to look like that. The casting director was like, "Oh, can you join with my cousin?" And she also made it very clear, like, you probably won't hear anything back because it's like showcase season for drama schools and stuff. So don't get your hopes up. And then, like, within a week, Maddie and Sienna at Hamilton Hotel would, or within a couple of days, had emailed me, and I met with them, and that was a clear decision. It was the best one I ever made. And then a month after being with them, I got two jobs, and then a year later I got two leads in a film, and then a year later Sex Ed. So that's sort of the journey that I've been on, really. That do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
From Michael telling me you can do this.
And you're still in touch with Michael?
Yeah, we speak all the time, actually. Yeah. He's been I remember, This is, but because I was so poor at the time, when I met him was when I was really going through it with my dad, and the home situation was really on the rocks, and I had very bad, I think depression. Like, I would cry most nights. Do you know what I mean? Because I was like, this fucked.
Would you cry for a specific reason, or would you not know?
I would
why
cry because crying? I was like, am I going to live here in this? Like, I'm talking, when I mean poor, I mean like there's no carpet on the floor and there's a mattress on the floor.
Yeah.
And like no wall, like shitty wallpaper and stuff, like real rough. And our flat was just a shithole at the time as well, because we had moved out of my grandmother's massive house where there was a swimming pool. My grandfather had built it, and all the stuff had been taken in this two bedroom. So we were living within this city in this, do you know what I mean? This metropolis of cardboard boxes.
Yeah.
So it was it didn't feel like a home. And then this whole tension was going on with me and my dad, and I kind of didn't feel like I had any family at that point. And
did you feel quite lost at that point?
Oh yeah, for sure. And you know, boxing had sort of fallen away, and that was probably the only thing that had made me keep my head down for a long time, and now that had gone. And
so that one bit of structure in your life and discipline had gone
completely. Now I wanted to be an actor, and I had no idea what I meant to do, but I just knew that I was wanted to do it, and that I was going to do it somehow.
Do you still feel passionate about it?
Not as much. No, I think I really to and fro with it now. There are times where I'm like, Maddie and Sandy are going to kill me for saying this, but there are times where I do think I'm going to call them up and be like, I'm done. Do you know what I mean?
No, but you see, you say that. I understand why you're saying it. But there's things that crop up on doing this, and you know, God, what are we now? I don't know, 90-something episodes in. And the amount, especially when I speak to certain actors, even actually when I spoke to musicians, and they've gone, do you know what? My record sales are shit, and I feel I've done the best work I can do there. No radio is playing me. What's the point? What's the point? And actors feel like that as well all the time. I think creatives and artists of all sorts just feel like it at one point, because, you know, that fire was so strong when I started, and it can't burn as brightly all the time, can it?
And I feel guilty because it's come with sort of success. Is that now I'm, and it's that which makes me want to sometimes pack it in, because I think, especially because acting for me is so, I don't know how to do it without really doing it. So in like emotional scenes, I remember I did a film a couple of years ago called Verses, which was about this, it was about a foster kid that goes looking for his mum, effectively. after they've been estranged for over like 10, 11 years. So it sort of felt to me, oh, this is probably as close as I'm going to get to ever actually seeing my mum again or saying the things that I always wanted to say to her. And in those scenes that were, they were just so horrendously taxing for me, and I had no way of getting out easily. I would, like, people would just stupid, like, people would have to come over and cuddle. Like, I remember I did the audition with Julie Harkin, and she, in that audition, I couldn't even get to the end of the page because I just broke down in tears, and everyone was around giving me a hug and stuff, and I just thought, this is not what I meant. I can't sustain this at all. I don't have the whatever muscle it is, I don't have it to fucking.
I don't know if it's about a muscle. I mean, that's a release of some sort, exactly. Isn't it? You're tapping in to sort of your past grief, which is fucking, you know, that's amazing.
It's amazing, but it's also shit when you're doing scenes where you're not trying to do that, and suddenly I'm in a flood of tears and I've run out of set.
Because, and you're broke.
Exactly. And it wasn't even required. It just sort of happened, and that's when I think I can't do this anymore. I don't care about the fucking. I don't care enough to be able to have to go through this all the time. And then it will sort of, I won't work for about a year. And then by the time that year's over, I think, okay, I can do it again now. And luckily enough, I'll get a job.
It sounds like you just, you know, everything sort of breaks down with that specific job and 100% goes in. But then you need that time off to fix and put yourself back together. So there needs to be some sort of control, doesn't there?
And I think, you know, as I've got older, that time, that duration has shortened.
Right.
In between jobs, in between taking a break, do you know what I mean?
And does that mean because you're getting more control over it, or the healing time is quicker?
Both, I guess, both.
Well, that's surely a positive.
Yeah, and I think... And being with my girlfriend as well, she's definitely helped with that in that she is an actor, and she sometimes it's that thing. Sometimes I'll catch myself slipping into that old thing of thinking that I'm not doing an honourable job or because of my brothers and what they do and that they really work hard for a living.
So that guilt comes back.
So that's coming in as well.
Yeah.
While there's also the fact that I can't handle my own emotions is coming in. And then all the other shit of like, oh, now, you know, the phone hasn't rang, so now maybe... So then there's that on top of it as well.
Oh, man, that's always going to be there.
Exactly.
You know, the phone thing, that's just part and parcel.
Absolutely.
We can never control that. But the other things, at least we can try and get a grip on, you know? Because then at least it's a healthy way forward within ourselves. I don't know.
With my girlfriend, because she's great theatre actress, she has definitely taught me that, oh, and I've been blessed to work with such amazing people. I did a film with Peter Mullen when I was 20.
Oh, man.
We text each other all the time, and he was the best mentor to me of being like, and we sort of had similar situations with our dads growing up in a similar way. And I think he definitely saw, and he really took me under his wing. And just is the first one to be like, yeah, but you don't actually have to feel it, mate. Do you know what I mean? Like, you can fake it. You can fake it. You don't have to feel it. And he understands that, you know, sometimes you can't help but feel it in certain situations because it is this weird thing where you're replicating something that might have happened to you, and it's hard to detach from that sometimes.
Well, that's where it overrides and it can get out of control.
Absolutely.
And if you are breaking down, it's cut. The camera's cut, but you're still in a curled up ball in a fetus position on the floor, balling your eyes out, then that's not good for you.
Alistair Petrie as well, who plays my dad in Sex Education.
Yeah, lovely.
He's
man.
The fucking best.
It
was a particular scene that me and him were doing together. And what was worse is that my girlfriend is Amy in the show.
Right.
So the scene that's happening and what's taking place is we're at prom. There's about 200 extras in the room. And she's kissing this lovely actor named Chris Jenks. And I'm in the scene, I'm watching this happen. And then the scene comes to a head with me telling my dad that I hate him, effectively, which is Alistair Petrie. So I start crying at this thing with my dad, but all 200 extras think I'm crying because I'm seeing my girlfriend kissing this lovely lad. Lovely man. He's a lovely man.
Yeah.
He wouldn't hurt a fly. And he's freaking out, like, what the fuck is going on with this kid? And now I've run out screaming. And the crew are like, what is going on? JJ's run after me. My girlfriend's run after me. I'm sat in Cardiff on the side street, bawling my eyes out.
Oh, man alive.
But then Alistair, he came over and he was like, listen. And he completely got the situation and he was just reconfirming that, like, you know, you don't have to, this isn't real right now. You know, it's you have every right to feel those emotions, but you being an actor is your lesson is going to be how to control yourself.
Yeah.
Which you don't have a grip on right now, and that's fine because you're 22.
Exactly.
Not a lot of 22-year-olds do, and now you're doing this weird thing where you sort of haven't done it before, so...
And also, not a lot of 22s are all thrust in to be, like, all these leads in this massive fucking show that's dropping around the world and everybody's dropping the kecks, and it's like... there's a lot of stuff that, as somebody who's been acting for 20 years, when I watched it, I went, I wouldn't do that now, let alone at 22.
Yeah, yeah,
do you know
what
I mean? But you obviously... Who's JJ? Is he a producer?
Yeah, John.
But obviously, he's created a very sort of safe environment for you all to do that and to feel that it's okay.
Yeah.
Which doesn't happen a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it does a lot, but it doesn't as well. At the same time, there would be places where people would be exploited.
Yeah. It's definitely it had to be a safe environment for all of us because of the nature of the show.
That's all I was thinking of when I was watching it. I was enjoying it, but I was watching it as an actor going, oh my God, these poor kids, they're all right, I hope they're looked after, you know?
Yeah, for sure. We've got the best team around us making sure that everything's fine because it is the most like visceral, naked experience doing that show, especially for the girls on it. Yeah, I mean...
How do you feel going forward, though? Do you think you're getting more control over yourself?
I think that I'm just not afraid to tackle my own problems as much. I'm just not afraid to... I'm just not afraid to be... I think the difference between what I'm trying to say is that I feel like acting for me will always be this push and pull, like it is with every actor.
Yeah.
And that I shouldn't be so, what's the word? Like, I shouldn't think of myself as this fucking prince. Cause that's what it boils down to, is me being like, oh, I'm so emotionally.
Do you think that, or do you think you're just giving yourself a hard time about that? Cause I mean, you know, we've just been sat here. I don't see that at all. I don't see any bit of that in you. But of course, I've just met you.
Yeah.
But I don't think so. I think that's probably you giving yourself a bit more of a hard time than what you should, to be honest.
Maybe. I think I just feel that sometimes I feel a bit, I definitely feel guilt in some level because of this whole thing with my dad. And then, you know, I definitely, and I don't really, maybe I'll never figure it out, but the fact that my mum, I mean, any problem I've ever experienced with my life can always be brought back to that moment where my mum died. And getting to terms with that there's always going to be this albatross flying over my head, which is her haunting me effectively, coming to terms with that will never go was hard. And then dealing with that all the time is hard. So like, do you know what I mean? Coming to terms with the fact that I'm never going to get over that, really.
No, because she's always going to be there watching over you, really, to an extent.
I feel like, fuck, what have I missed out on? Or there'll be times where I'll be in groups of people that are talking shit about their mum or something like that. And I'm like, you no fucking idea. I wish I could had shit to talk about my mum.
Yeah, of course.
Or we'll all be hanging out with everyone's family. And I'm like, I don't really have this structure. And that can come across sometimes as I'll be sat in a group situation and I'll just... And I was talking about this the other day with a couple of friends, that I'll just completely emotionally flatline. And like, I just can't. And I'll be sat there thinking, I haven't spoken fucking 20 minutes. I need to speak. And I can't. I'm like, it's like I'm literally paralyzed in my head. I'm like screaming, I need to say something right now. Because, and I'm definitely, I'm definitely a super shy person. And it probably doesn't seem that way because I've just fucking waffled on. But
no, but you see, I can sense that shyness in you totally from having this conversation with you. But again, that's all right.
Yeah.
You know, we all know those actors who are kind of big and that's all right. You know, that's their journey. That's who they are. Or is it? I don't know. I think you need to stop giving yourself too much of a hard time, Connor, be honest.
Yeah.
So how do you feel about moving forward and starting this other series? You feel you're going to get more of a grip?
I do. I think it's just about... And sometimes I do stop giving myself a hard time because I think because of the whole hard situation that I grew up with, I'm like, I had to grow up super fucking quick and I had to take care of myself very early on because I felt like I couldn't. And me and my dad not having any money and then living with him, I always felt like I didn't have someone where if shit really went wrong, I couldn't call up my dad and be like, Dad, I need 20 quid to get the bus. Or I just didn't even have that. So it was like, okay, so I always have to make sure that I've got enough money if ever I need it, because there's no one that I can rely on to come and help me if I get in trouble. Not because of anyone's fault, but because my dad's disabled and he lives on benefits. So he has barely enough money for himself, let alone to take care of a 16-year-old kid. And then my brothers live really far away. In a heartbeat, they would give me money. But if it was midnight, they'd be, you know, it's... And that, I think anyone that's been through that gets what I mean when I say that it's just, it can be hard not knowing that you've got support if ever you needed it. And now I'm at a point where I'm like, well, I have money now and I've got people around me that love me and care about me. So the thing that I battle with is like, I fucking push it away and I'm...
Because you don't want them to leave.
It's like this constant push and pull that I've had. I don't want you to leave now, so I'll just push you away.
But get away.
Exactly.
Quick. Yeah.
And then I freak out the moment those people do leave or show any, or when someone, you know, challenges that or calls my bluff, then I'll freak out when, but I definitely am. But then I'm like, that's just me growing up. I'm 22.
Exactly, man.
I need to stop treating life like I'm 45, which it feels like I have done for a long time.
Yeah.
Just need to be a kid.
I think that's part and parcel of being forced to grow up too quick.
Right.
Just speaking about money, do you have a different, not a different perspective, that's not the right thing. Do you respect money now?
If I catch myself sometimes.
Because you earn it yourself.
I do. I mean, I caught myself the other day, me and my girlfriend were having a debate, and she said this thing of, why do actors get paid more than other actors? And I said, well, if I was to get paid more than someone else, it's because I deserve it. Do you get what I mean? Like, my fucking mum died. I deserve that money.
Right, okay.
And she went, okay. Right. And then I sort of, I'm defending that debate. I'm like, you know, I grew up, you know, me and my dad, we had no money growing up, so of course I deserve that money. But then also part of me is like, we all should get paid the same. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Why is this person not getting paid as much as this person? And why are the boys getting paid more than the girls or whatever it is? But then I think if someone was to turn around and say, Connor, we're going to pay you blah, blah, blah to do this film and everyone else, but you know everyone else is going to get this much. My first instinct would be, yeah, rightly fucking so.
the whole pay, that's a whole other podcast all to itself. Connor, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you very much. Sorry that I fucking waffled on.
It was right. Do you enjoy it?
Yeah, I loved it.
Yeah, it was right.
Yeah.
I think you should come back on after the end of series two and tell me all how it went.
Absolutely, yeah. I'd love to.
All right, nice one, man.
Thank you.
And another episode is done. And there's not really much to say after that. If Connor's listening, I want to thank Connor for coming on and being so candid and honest. And you for downloading and subscribing. And that's it. We will see you next week for episode 84. Until then, I've been Craig Parkinson. He's been producer Griff. And this has been
the Two Shot Podcast. You take care of yourself, okay? See ya. The Two Shot Podcast is presented by me, Craig Parkinson, recorded and produced by Thomas Griffin for Splicing Block. Our music, our brilliant music, is courtesy of Then Thickens. Cheers.